Welcome to the Mission Driven Budget Podcast, where we help you ditch your financial stress, grow your organization's budget, and fund your mission, one conversation at a time. I'm your host, Paul Rice. In this episode, I sit down with Jack Clark III to talk about how to engage high-wealth donors and move them from just being interested in your organization to actually making a donation. Jack is a businessman, a family man, an entrepreneur, and is heavily involved in his church, and he has some very unique perspectives. You won't want to miss the fascinating story about how Jack got involved in the world of sales and business. Please enjoy my conversation with Jack Clark. Jack, how's it going, man?
Good, man. How are you?
Doing good. Real excited to get to have this conversation with you. Man, let's jump right into it. You've got a pretty interesting story. When we first connected, you know, you said that one of the reasons that you kind of got into the sales type of world, finance type of world, is because your dad said he couldn't afford to help pay for college, and that lit a fire under you. Can you kind of walk us through like that motivation and where that took you?
Sure. So when I was 18, my dad sat me down and said, "Son, I love you with all my heart, but I'm broke as a joke, and we can't afford to put you through school, so you're on your own." And I remember at 18, I applied for 52 scholarships, you know, to go to different public, you know, universities here in Texas.
Wow.
And thank God that three of the 52 said, "Hey, we see some potential here," and I ended up getting a full ride to UT in Austin. And so that was just a great, you know, kind of starting point into college. And
yep.
But then, my first semester in college, I accidentally flooded the dorms at the University of Texas at Austin.
So how do you accidentally flood a dorm?
So, man, this story will haunt me until the day I die. But I was never that kid that partied. I was never that kid that really got in trouble. But I've always been that guy where, you know, the second you slightly step outside the boundary, it's almost like the wrath of God will just keep me in line. I think he's just fashioning integrity for the long term. But one night in my dorm, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm studying for some exam. And some of my buddies came into the room and said, "Hey, Jack, there's this thing in the hallway. We don't know what it is. Do you know what it is?" So I walk out in the hallway and I look up, and it's just this button. It's just this thing on the wall. There's no warning. It's not red. There's no latch. We had no clue what it was. So I jumped and tapped it, and then I tapped it a little harder, and then I basically punched it, and it turned out to be a recessed sprinkler head. So the sprinkler goes off, and it starts shooting out. I think it was over the 45 minutes it was on, it was about 5,000 gallons of water. And so they couldn't turn it off. They didn't know how to stop it. And long story short, I got in big trouble for that, as I should. And the University of Texas charged me a hefty amount of money to pay restitution for damage to the floors and people's stuff. And the water leaked through and hit the kids on the floor below. Computers were destroyed. Clothes were destroyed. So I got a hefty bill my freshman year of college. Again, my dad said, "Son, I love you, but I'm broke as a joke, so I can't help you." And so that summer I got a job selling books door to door with a company out of Nashville. And it was a straight commission job, working 85 hours a week over the summer, being relocated to a different part of the country. And my first summer, I made about $30,000. Yeah. And help pay off my bills.
There you go.
So I learned at 19 that I had a knack for commission sales, direct sales, and then that was a skill that I continued to develop in different ways. And there you go.
And you took that into a private insurance company, became the youngest director, I think is what you said.
Yeah.
You also joined Raymond James, an investment firm, and that's where you really started connecting with some high wealth donors, helping them navigate tax implications of charitable contributions and things like that. And then recently you started a new business with your wife called the Buggy Huggy. And
that's right.
Before we go any further,
sure.
My wife and I argue all the time as to whether the thing at the grocery store is called a buggy or a cart.
Right.
And I pointed to this product. I said, "Honey, You see a buggy right there. I think it's a buggy. She thinks it's cart. What do you say?"
So the South, down here in the South, we call them buggies.
It's a buggy.
But the majority of the country does call them shopping carts. You hear trolley a lot in the Northeast.
You do, yeah.
And in Europe and in England. But I'd say the majority of people in the U.S. call them shopping carts or baskets. But down here in the South, we call them buggies.
I noticed that most of your verbiage on the website for the Buggy Huggy, you said Buggy Huggy, and then you
diverted the shopping cart afterwards. Right. So I figured you were, you know, obviously not just targeting the South, but I just loved the name. That was so fascinating to me. So, you know, you've been through all this stuff. You've also connected with Transform Haiti. Pastor Josh Brown mm-hmm. and Pastor Leslie Brown are kind of heading that up. You came on to help on their board and did a lot of the grunt work there. You mm-hmm. said at the kind of the beginning of when you joined, it was moving out of a kind of one phase, and you're kind of moving into a new chapter as yep. some of the older folks are moving out and making room for some fresh ideas. You have started a business. You're working with a nonprofit. You've been a part of sales. You've been a part of an investment firm, and you've had to learn how to secure funding mm-hmm. all throughout your career here. What are the most effective strategies? What are some effective strategies that you found that a church, especially a small church or even a mid-sized church, might be able to utilize to help secure funding? Maybe they're a church plant just getting started. Maybe they've been around for a long time. We've got a fresh pastor coming in, and they just need some advice. Mm. What kind of strategies would you advise them to take?
Sure. And it's not glamorous, and it's not some secret formula, but I'll tell you, when it comes to nonprofits, when it comes to church plants, if people are going to give money, they need to know that the guy or gal in charge is 100% passionate, convicted, and sold out to the cause. And if they're not, and there's any kind of reluctance there, if that pastor is pursuing a job and not a calling, if there's any reluctance in how bought in are you,
right,
it's really difficult for entrepreneurs, business owners, you know, givers to sow into a new ministry or a new nonprofit. And yep. so first and foremost, I would tell those starting pastors or new pastors or people looking to start a, you know, nonprofit, if it's just a job, if it's a thing they're trying to do, if they're looking to get their feet wet and try something out, you know, good luck. Yep. What a tough journey. But if you're called, if you're convicted, if you're sold out, if you're willing to do whatever it takes to make that thing work, then people are going to see that and they're going to know that. And so I've seen guys try to start things with a half-hearted mentality.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what they do to raise funds. It just doesn't really work out that well.
Yeah.
And it may take 5 years to raise the funds that they needed that they could have done in 5 months. And so before any methods are shared, I would say that person, that man or woman, that couple, they need to have a undying passion for what they're about to embark on.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get behind someone in that field that's not. And so, you know, if someone does have that kind of conviction and passion and they're sold out on what they're doing and they're committed for the long run, then, you know, it's not glamorous. But I think the best way of raising funds is going face to face. And I think there's, you know, three different tiers. You can go face to face. I would say that's tier one. You can make phone calls, which I would say is tier two. And then you can send letters and emails, which is tier three. And at the end of the day, I've learned this. You never know who's going to give what. The people that you think would give the most give hardly anything. Yeah. The people that you would never think would give write a big $5,000 check to your new ministry. You just never know. And so you can do your best to put these different people in those tiers. But at the end of the day, you just never know who's going to do what. But I've helped coach people. I've personally done this. But if I have a list of, you know, 1,000 contacts, I might take the top 100. And those are tier one contacts. Those are people that I have a strong relationship mm-hmm. with. They trust me. They know me. They know my character. They know what I'm about. They know that my yes means yes. And as hard as it may be, I block off 4 to 6 weeks and I'll go meet with those people. Wow. I'll go meet them in the evenings, on the weekends, and for breakfast, whatever it takes. You got to have that face to face. And if you've got that kind of relational equity with people,
yeah,
it's not using it. It's you've got that relationship with them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so sending that person a letter, I think, is a slap in their face. I really do. Yeah. Sending letters is very lazy. And so with that type of relationship, you know, if you're serious about what you're doing, then take the 30 minutes, take the 45 minutes to an hour, have a breakfast, have a lunch, and, you know, pitch your vision, pitch what you're doing, get them involved. And so, you know, I would do that with the first 100 people. The next 300 people that may not be as strong of a relationship, but they're still somewhat strong, I would call those people on the phone and I'd have a phone call, 15, 20, 30 minutes, pitch the vision. you've got to pitch the vision. And then the remaining people who you don't really have a relationship with, but they kind of, you kind of know, those are the people that you send letters to, you send emails to.
Yeah.
But I've just seen too many, you know, startup pastors, people starting nonprofits, missionaries trying to raise funds for long-term missions. And all they do is send out these mass emails and these mass letters, and and they might get some funds. They will get some funds,
sure,
but they're just missing out on what they really need. And I honestly see that as a sign of laziness. And I honestly see that as a sign of, you know, are you really that convicted in what you're doing if you can't go look people in the eyes and ask them? I know that's a tough skill. I hear a lot of people say, man, that's just really hard to, you know, look for people and ask for money. Well, as Christians, you know, we pray and we ask God for our needs every day.
Yeah.
And so, you know, sometimes God uses the men and women in our life to provide those needs. And if we're serious about what we're doing, then I don't see the harm. I don't see the difficulty of taking it one step further and saying, hey, brother, hey, sister, here's what I'm doing. This is what, you know, God's doing in my life. Do you want to be a part of it?
Yeah.
And it's just a simple yes or no. And, you know, if people are afraid of that no, then, you know, they better be careful starting a church or starting a nonprofit, because they're going to deal with a lot more than rejection.
Yeah, for sure.
So,
but anytime you put yourself out there, it's an automatic risk, right?
Yep.
People might say no. They might laugh in your face. Who knows what's going to happen?
Yep.
But if you're really passionate about what you're doing, you'll at least be willing to make the ask.
Yep.
What you just said, you know, some people say that's kind of a hard skill. I wanted to follow up with what's the best kind of information to put in a pitch to somebody, whether it's face to face or phone call? What's kind of the best information that people who are looking to make a donation might really want to hear?
The reality is, at the end of the day, that person is making a donation into you. They are believing in you. It's not always the mission. It's not always the local church. I mean, for the average person and donor, a church is a church. If a church is highly gifted in evangelism versus discipleship versus doing outreaches and food banks versus having a heavy missions focus, the average donor doesn't really know the difference. To them, a church is a church.
I see.
And so a nonprofit is a nonprofit. Maybe there's a different cause, but it boils, are you feeding orphans? Are you feeding widows? Are you doing a homeless outreach? It's a good cause. You know, most people sum up a church in their mind as a church, and they sum up a nonprofit as a good cause.
Sure.
And so at the end of the day, that person, they are potentially investing money in the person, in the person that's running it. Is that person trustworthy?
Yeah.
What's their character? And if you've had a pretty wishy-washy character, if you don't have a ton of integrity, it's tough to expect people to sow into you, because you've got a reputation that might hold you back a little bit. And so I tell guys looking to start things like this, you know, your reputation does matter. It's very important. If you have a reputation of being reliable, of doing what you say, of walking in integrity, of following through, then, yeah, I can trust you with that money.
Yeah.
Especially a big donor. They don't want to think that they don't want that money to be squandered.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think people are investing in the person in the beginning.
Yeah.
As much as they are the cause or the church or the mission.
How do you establish a repertoire with somebody or that you maybe don't know? Maybe kind of like you and me, for example. I got your name through Josh Brown.
Yep.
That's how he knows you. And here we are having a conversation.
Yep.
If somebody has been connected with somebody, you know, through another person that they don't know, you know, if that person, you know, is saying, you know, hey, I'm making an investment to you, I'm making an investment to this organization, how do you develop a relationship with them so quickly?
Sure.
With little to no background info.
This is great. I'll speak from personal experience. My wife and I get asked maybe 15 times a year to sow into different missionaries.
Yeah.
And I can't think of a time where one asked me face to face and we said no.
Hmm.
But the reality is, it's probably only been 3 or 4 times in 5 years where someone's asked me face to face.
Really?
Really. And so I think when people take that effort to reach out to someone that they don't know. These are people I didn't know.
Yeah.
People I had no clue. They got referred to me by someone else. When they took the time to set up a time to meet with us, to pitch their vision, I didn't care what it was. I really didn't care what it was. If it was advancing the gospel, great, we're in.
Yeah.
Regardless of how they advance the gospel, I really didn't care that much. But I appreciated the fact that they cared enough about what they were doing to look me in the eyes and pitch their vision.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just because I'm a sales guy, but I just think a lot of people appreciate the fact that it's not just another letter. Guys like me, we get a lot of letters. We get a lot of requests. We get a lot of opportunities. Pitch it however you want to pitch it. But I just have a little bit more respect for the person that believes enough about what they're doing to meet with me and tell me about what they're looking to do. And in that meeting, you know, we're all a good judge of character. Sure. You know, we have a discerning spirit. If I don't think they're knuckleheads, if I don't think they're liars, if I think they're going to follow through what they say, then there's a good chance I'm going to support them.
Wow.
The only other missing carrot is, do you have a long-term vision? And I think new pastors and people starting nonprofits, they need to know what their long-term vision is. Because I'm not looking to sow into someone that's going to try something out for the next 3 to 6 months. And if it doesn't work out, they're going to move on down the road. Like I said, I want someone who's called, convicted, sold out. They're going to do whatever it takes. What do you really see 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now?
Right.
You know, what is your vision? And whether it happens or not, I just want to know you have a long-term vision.
Yeah.
Because if your vision only goes 6 months and this thing ain't working out, you're gone. And to me, that's wasted funds that could have been used, you know, somewhere else.
Sure. Yeah, I had a follow-up question for you, but I think you've answered it there in terms of long-term vision. The question is going to be, and maybe you can elaborate if you want to, or you can just say, hey, but the long-term vision fully applies. Let's say a church has made this connection, the donor is interested, or maybe just wants to know a little bit more information. How can a church prepare to receive, especially a large donation in particular? What kind of planning can a church do to prepare to ask somebody for a donation?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's in terms of planning for the long-term vision and know where they're going. Is there other things that they might need to kind of have set in place before they approach somebody about something like that?
If we're talking church plant, totally different ballgame than if we're talking established church who's looking to now spread and increase their vision of what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, church plant, I think if a church planter is reaching out to people, they understand that that long-term goal, it's going to take, you know, 3-5 years to really get that church up and going.
Yeah.
I think they understand that long-term vision. And, you know, regardless of if that church has a special, you know, bent towards evangelism, discipleship, missions, worship, whatever it is, outreaches, you know, there's a church about 45 minutes from here, and they are huge on missions.
Yeah.
Majority of their budget goes to missions. There's another church I know of that they're huge on food bank. A big chunk of their budget goes to a food bank, whereas, you know, other churches don't even touch food banks. So some churches have special bents, but I think if you're talking about a church already established.
Yeah, let's go there.
Already going, and they're looking to expand their vision. I've seen churches start legacy teams, giving teams, almost like a separate ministry in and of itself. I really believe that the gift of giving is a spiritual gift. Someone doesn't have to have a lot of money to operate in that gift. People can, you know, make just a decent salary, but they're the people that are constantly giving. You know, anything given to them, it's just going in one hand and out the other. And they give sacrificially. And so it's not just high wealth individuals that have, you know, that gift of giving. And so I've seen a lot of churches start separate, you know, ministries, and it's not manipulation. If their heart is pure and their heart is right, it's truly a ministry for these people to operate in their gifts and to sow into kingdom initiatives outside of just their tithe. And so, you know, churches have offerings and opportunities to do offerings for other things that they're supporting.
Yeah.
But I've seen churches start separate teams. They can call them legacy teams. They can call them, you know, whatever teams. And that's a great way of reaching people.
Do churches tend to create enough opportunities for people to donate, in your experience?
You know, I think the vast majority of churches across America, I think the statistic is about 80% of churches in America are less than 100 people.
Yep.
And so if that's the statistic, I think many of these churches, you know, they definitely don't have big enough vision to really need to ask for more. I think many of them are content in the, you know, congregation that they have. It's a giant family. There's a special, you know, feel of a small church like that. It's there's so many wonderful things about that.
Mm-hmm.
success in church and in Christianity is not based on numbers.
Yep.
And it's based on, you know, disciples. Yep. Are we making disciples?
Relationship.
Exactly. And, yeah. And I think in many cases, smaller churches are more geared to do a better job with discipleship. But I think the bigger the church, the bigger the budget, there are more opportunities to do things with that money. And
yeah.
Many of them, maybe they don't ask, or they don't have, you know, big enough vision for that, because many of them are doing their best just to keep the ship afloat and to keep, you know, pulling off every Sunday all the different things they're already doing.
Yeah.
And so I think part of that, too, is just different stages of growth.
Sure.
An organization and where they're at.
Yeah, exactly. Let's stay in the same kind of vein here in terms of, you know, going for the ask. You know, when you're going to pitch something to particularly like a high wealth donor, maybe somebody owns a business and they are a part of your church and they support your church. And let's say that you're a church and you are trying to expand your vision. We talked about the established churches just a moment ago. Obviously, anybody who's looking to donate is wanting to make sure that the leaders are passionate about the mm-hmm. cause that they are leading. When we spoke on the phone, you know, you also said that donors are also looking for some level of results. They want to see something coming out of yep. whatever money that they are donating to this cause. They want to see some kind of progress. I suspect that maybe the results that what I'll call the typical donor is looking for might be a little different, aside from making sure that the leader is passionate and mm-hmm. from seeing some kind of results. What are some things that maybe a high wealth donor is looking for that the typical donor might not be?
Sure. I believe that a high net worth individual has a vast amount of more experience with money and managing money
right.
than a non-high net worth individual. And so guys that have a vast experience of managing money, many times these guys have more experience, you know, than the financial director of the church and you know, the leadership team of the church. And they respect that.
Yeah.
And they understand that. Just as they're probably theologians sometimes within a congregation that probably know the word better than the pastor
right.
themselves.
Yeah. But,
you know, pastor has his role and, you know, they yep. have their role. Yep. And so I would say, though, that high net worth individuals, they're constantly thinking about protecting assets, growing assets. They think about money differently
yeah.
than the average person. And I think part of their thought process is always expecting a return on their investment.
Yeah.
And in the business world, in the finance world, that's measured in dollars and cents. If I invest XYZ, I expect, you know, 20, 30, 40% return. I expect, you know, this over this amount of time. It doesn't translate that way into kingdom business.
Yep.
But I still think high net worth individuals have a mindset of expecting a return on their investment.
Yeah.
So when they give to a cause, when they give to a local church, and the vision that was pitched was, hey, you know, we want to do XYZ, they want to know that XYZ is actually happening.
Yep.
And not just was that wing of the building completed, not just was the remodel done properly, but how does that translate into advancing the gospel?
Yeah.
How many souls were saved? How many, you know, missionaries were sent? How does that translate into, you know, metrics of the gospel? And I think when high net worth individuals see that the dollars that they're donating are actually having an impact in the kingdom,
yeah,
then that's a really easy thing to continue to pour into.
For sure. Let me throw a scenario at you. Let's say a church, and we'll just go back to COVID here, you know, 2020. Church is shutting down, at least temporarily, having to make this move online. And there's a lot of resources involved with that,
mm-hmm.
especially if you're not there already. Yep. That was a pivot that my church made. We had plans to go online in 2020.
Yep.
They were rapidly accelerated as a result of the pandemic.
Mm.
So let's say we've got a church in that kind of scenario, and they say, okay, we now have a vision to go online. We've got to make this switch, and we've got to do it quickly.
Yep.
They encounter somebody in their church who has some money, is interested in funding this effort because they know that it's going to help people stay engaged and connected while they're sitting at home. It also has the potential to reach other people maybe that have never been able to be reached before.
Yep.
All churches are different, right? What would be some examples in that kind of a scenario? They're investing in this online ministry, online church streaming, maybe it's throughout the week, whatever it is. What are some examples of results that they might like to see as coming out of an investment into an online type of situation?
Sure. And I've seen many churches have to make that shift.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of churches who had the foresight to have already been making that shift even before COVID happened.
Yep.
Part of the reality is millennials live online. Today's 20, 30-year-olds, they, for the most part, live online. They live on social media. It is a language for them.
Yeah.
Some of them are socially inept. Some of them cannot have face-to-face conversations. But all of them are comfortable online.
Yeah.
And that is a generation that spends a lot of their time online, social media platforms or whatever. And so if we as a church are to go out of the four walls and reach people where they're at, there's a generation that's online. And we're not changing our methods just to keep up with the times.
Yep.
I think there's still an argument to be made that we're being evangelistic by meeting them where they're at.
Sure.
And there's a generation that is online. And so I think when a church is looking to make shifts like that in either how they do ministry or getting equipment to do something different, or even when it comes to buildings and build outs and whatever, if a pure argument can be made of, hey, we're doing this to reach people, to advance the gospel, to meet people where they're at, if that's the pure motive, and I believe it is most of the time, if that's the pure motive, I can get behind that as a donor. If building out a new kids playground is the heart behind it is truly to reach more families in a day and age where they are consumer Christians and they're looking for the flashy things, and if that's even a hook to get people in to eventually minister to a family, I can buy that. What I can't buy is, excessive things just for excessive things. And we've got an excess in our budget, so, hey, why don't we just do whatever? And so not my decision to make. And I think for a lot of business owners or business people or high net worth individuals, sometimes that's frustrating to them because in their minds they could probably manage the budget better. But it's not their decision to make, and they can get over that pretty quick. But I think those guys and gals, they need to know that, you know, are the funds actually being used to fulfill the mission of the organization?
Yeah.
And like you said on our first call, so many churches and organizations, they really don't know their mission. They're not really clear on their mission.
Yeah.
And so anytime they get any extra funds or have a little surplus in the budget, they're just trying this and they're trying that with no clear direction. And that's really frustrating for guys like me.
Yeah, that mission really provides the guardrails. It really helps make your financial decisions easier to make. I know I have talked with pastors who, you know, oh, we've got a little extra money, or maybe money's even tight, but they have no clear reasoning behind what they're spending other than we're just functioning.
Right.
We're operating on Sundays, and maybe we have a Wednesday night service, and we do small groups, and that's it.
Yeah.
They have no actual driving focus behind where to put their money, and financial decisions stress them out because they're sitting there going, where does this money need to go?
Sure.
Well, let's just try this, or let's just try that. Oh, this is the new hot thing. Let's try that.
Right.
And they end up effectively squandering that money in the long run because it's not making a return on their overall investment.
Yep. And we all make mistakes. Business owners make mistakes. We all try things and take risks, and you know, and there's grace for that for all of us.
Oh, sure.
But there is something to be said about you can't stay in your lane if you don't know your lane.
Exactly.
So
I talked with a church in Lafayette, Indiana, and You were talking about churches being bent on particular things. They particularly excel at missions, or they particularly excel at benevolence, or mm-hmm. what have you. And their big thing, their pastors are foster parents
okay.
and have biological children of their own, too. But they are big into the foster community.
That's awesome.
And everything about that church goes into community service, particularly mm-hmm. with this new program that just opened up called the Foster Closet that mm-hmm. supports, you know, single moms and dads, you know, that have young children or fostering kids, things like that, provides clothes, supplies, equipment. But that is the church's mission.
Yeah.
Is that community service aspect.
Yep.
And when they make a financial decision, you know, they work to scrimp and to save money everywhere else
yep.
that they possibly can. And they just funnel it directly yep. into this mission.
Yeah.
And I just think that's so critical to have. And I know it definitely makes the financial decisions for them quite a bit easier because they know their mission. They know what they're trying to do. Man, let's keep digging a little bit deeper here. We talked about business owners, especially folks that have had a lot of experience managed money when they get into a church environment or they encounter a church, you know, kind of like yourself. You're an executive pastor here for a little while at Hill City, and you were the children's pastor too, right?
I was a kids pastor. I was never the executive
okay,
pastor.
I'm sorry.
But I definitely, yeah. you know, went from apartment to department to department,
okay.
helping with systems and structures, and
yeah.
I never took on that title yet.
So you've had kind of this glimpse into the inner workings of how a church functions
yes.
and operates. And when we first connected, you had said that sometimes business owners, entrepreneurs, or high wealth individuals that get involved in a church at that level, they see these inefficiencies that you mm-hmm. were talking about earlier, and it can be kind of frustrating.
Yep.
But the church leadership might kind of be blind to it,
yeah.
you know, if that person is either not in a position to speak up,
right.
maybe it's not their role, or they might be afraid to, whatever the case is. What are some of the most common inefficiencies, financially speaking, that you see or you have seen in the church world that
sure.
if you could say something, it's like, oh, that frustrates me. What
sure.
are some of those things?
And I want to back up a little bit
yeah,
to help with this answer. So I think there aren't many guys like me who've gotten to get behind the curtain
yeah, exactly.
and really see
yeah.
what's going on. And so I don't think most business owners or guys like me get that clear of a picture.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
most of them are basically making their judgments from their vantage point, and it's really just their perception
yeah.
without ever being able to see behind the curtain. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So most guys won't really see behind the curtains. They're not going to see the books. Even being on staff, I never really saw the books, but I had a really good idea of, you know, where what was, you know, what was going where. I'll back up though. Ministry is different than business. They are different beasts.
Yep.
There is a business element of ministry, but the local church is not a business.
Right.
It's the body of Christ. It's not the building. It's not the service. It's the people that attend. It's a living organism. And so most business owners, they don't see it that way because their lens is business. And so I know a lot of wealthy men and women, they only see the church as a business.
Yeah.
They don't understand what the church really is. And because they just see it as a business, they get very upset by a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
I've known men that basically walked away from the Lord because of how the church was spending money
mm-hmm.
because
yeah.
they looked at the church as a business. And shame on them.
Sure.
You know, you should know Jesus a little bit better than that. But
yeah.
But so most business owners, they don't see the church as the church. They see it as a business. So for a lot of them, you know, tithe is income. Right.
Yep.
The building costs, you know, mortgage, rent, that's overhead. Outreaches, they'd call that marketing.
Yep.
And
yeah. Okay, I can see that.
You know,
yep.
staff is just, you know, more overhead and expenses. And so, if business owners see the church as a business, which it's not, there's a business element, but that's kind of how they see it.
Yeah.
And so the goal of a business is to make a profit.
Yep.
The goal of the ministry is to fulfill their mission, whatever
yeah.
that is. And sometimes that's going to lead to a profit. So, and that's not the driving focus and goal. So a business, by definition, they are obligated to eliminate all financial inefficiencies because their primary goal is to make a profit and to grow. That is their driving force and objective, a good business. But a ministry, their driving force and objective is not to eliminate financial inefficiencies. It's to fulfill the mission.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've known some churches. So here's an example of an inefficiency.
Yeah.
I've known some churches that will keep someone on staff even after they're no longer really producing or doing anything in the ministry anymore.
Hmm.
But they do it out of honor. I've known, you know, people who've been on staff for 10, 15 years, and they were with that church through the hardest, toughest time and growing it and going through tough seasons. And they're at a place now where, you know, they're not in the trenches anymore. They're not really producing. They're not adding value. They're not really engaged. They're not doing anything anymore. But almost out of a sense of honor, that person is still part of the fold and part of the family and still getting, you know, paid in some way, shape, or form. It may not be as much as they were,
sure,
but they're still getting paid. Whereas in a business, if you're no longer engaged, producing, adding value, you're gone.
Yeah.
Maybe you can come advise us from time to time for, you know, an hourly whatever, but you're not on payroll, right?
Right.
And so ministry is different than business. And business owners, if they're looking at the church through the lens of, you know, only it being a business, they're going to see inefficiencies in their eyes. They're not really inefficiencies because ministry is different than business.
Sure.
And so, you know, I've got a buddy that owns a big technology company, and he's connected to a, you know, pretty good sized church here in Dallas. And this building, the church, the building's paid for, you know, all their overhead's covered.
Yeah.
He knows what they bring in as far as tithe, and he has an idea of what the staff gets paid. And so in his mind, all the extra stuff that they do with the excess of funds that has nothing to do with advancing the gospel, it makes my friend mad. he gets angry.
Yeah.
To the point where he's thinking about leaving the church because he sees needs all over.
Right.
And here you have a church that's completely secure financially, but it's almost like everything that they're still bringing in is just, in his mind, making them better, making them bigger, making them whatever. And if the reach isn't getting greater, if the number of salvations isn't getting greater, in this guy's mind, they're abusing those resources.
Hmm.
When he sees needs everywhere, and in his mind, this church is so inwardly focused, then in his mind, it's an abuse of funds.
Oh, yeah.
To the point where he wants to say, see you guys, I'm going somewhere else where these guys have a bigger heartache. And again, you know, he's not the pastor of that church.
Of course.
No problem. But if we're talking perspectives of guys with money, I'm just telling you the conversations I've had with these guys and their perspectives. And so, you know, those are a couple examples.
Yeah.
You know?
So let's take it inward, maybe kind of from your perspective, because you have the opportunity to see the inner workings like that. We've got perceived inefficiencies because of a difference in perspective.
Yep.
What about inefficiencies, especially like in small to mid-sized churches where maybe they don't have just a ton of excess funds coming in?
Yep.
What are some of the, what I would say, real, you know, inefficiencies, like ones that really matter from an operational perspective? What are some of those things that you've seen that maybe churches just kind of have a propensity towards, and they could correct it to help maybe advance their mission even more quickly?
Sure. I'm part of a very healthy church. The church I'm a part of is very healthy financially. They have boundaries in place. Not only do they tithe 10% of what's given to missionaries, they save 10% of what comes in for future, you know, issues. And you know, you talked our first conversation about pastors having, you know, margin in their budgets.
Yeah.
You got to have margin in your budgets. I get the shoestring days when you're starting out, but
everybody goes through that.
At some point, you know, you get past that. And so, but as far as real inefficiencies, it's tough. Again, it's all perceived. And, you know, we aren't the pastors. And I respect the pastor for the load he has to carry, not just spiritually, but financially. And, you know, he has to walk in a level of faith that we as lay people and even staff don't have to.
Yeah.
And so at the end of the day, I withhold all criticism and judgment because he carries a mantle that I don't carry. And I have that level of respect for him or for them. And I think a lot of guys like me do. It's when you start seeing the misuse and the abuse that you know, you start to ask questions and, you know, whatever. But it's difficult because, you know, I've seen that where someone's still, you know, paid on staff to not really produce. And I journeyed that for a while. In my mind, I thought, man, what a waste of money, you know, because I know two other guys that are willing to, you know, work five times as hard to pull their weight in that ministry.
Yeah.
And they're sitting on the sidelines because, you know, Joe Blow over here is still getting, you know, paid. And so I've seen that and wrestled with that. But then I journeyed the honor aspect of it. And there's something there too. And so, you know, at the end of the day, there's decisions that they make that are different than the ones I have to make in a business. And and there's got to be some level of trust in that. But again, I think those inefficiencies are all perceived.
Yeah.
I mean, when you find out what some churches are spending on, you know, mail outs and advertising and billboards, you know, what you see as a perceived inefficiency, it just may be a season where they're just trying to reach more than we don't know the heart.
Sure. How would you differentiate between an efficiency and an abuse of money?
Yeah, I think an inefficiency is you think there'd probably be a better use of that money. Misuse or abuse is that's wrong. Like there's something inherently
wrong. There's a moral issue.
There's a moral issue. Like that's a wrong use of funds.
Yeah.
And so that's how I define the difference.
Gotcha.
I would say I've never been a part of a church like this, but building funds just for building funds, you know, the stuff that majority of people might consider excessive, and there's really no there's no purity of motive. It's let's get big to get big. I think there's a check in my spirit with that kind of, you know, materialism within a local church, and I've never been exposed to a church like that. I've seen them, you know, I've heard about them, but I think you want to see, in the same way, you know, you'd want to see a church that's, you know, frugal with their funds,
and
you know, they're creative in the way they do things, and you know, they care enough to look for deals, and you know, at the end of the day, most senior pastors that I meet, they do understand that it's the Lord's money, and they're not frivolous.
Yeah,
even the ones that aren't on shoestring budgets anymore.
Yeah,
you know, they know that they're accountable to the Lord.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
So they don't want to, you know, mess it up. So
that's great. It's good insight. I want to move on to this is not quite in the same vein as, you know, inefficiencies, but one thing I do see in other churches that I have visited, folks I have talked to, is a lot of times churches have a hard time making change inside the way that they do ministry.
Yep.
And they continue funding programs or ministries that are no longer actually advancing the mission.
Yep.
And as a result, that money, you know, effectively from the mission's perspective, is going down the proverbial drain. And although the motive may be there and the heart may be in the right place.
Yeah.
Why do churches find themselves in those situations? They've got 15 different ministries, and you know, none of you know, only half of them really are funding and supporting the mission. How does that happen? And what kind of systems should churches be implementing to identify and maybe redirect some of those finances into projects that could be advancing their mission, or maybe just prevent it from happening in the first place?
Yeah, I think those that are already there, it can't prevent it now.
Yeah, exactly.
They're there. But I think, you know, I'm not a senior pastor, you know, but when I was a pastor on staff as a kids pastor and a small group pastor,
at least once a year, I'd reevaluate everything that we were doing. At least once a year, I'd look at everything, the volunteers, the structure, you know, curriculum, you know, org charts, job descriptions. Some of the things I've already said, a lot of small churches might not even have.
Yeah.
Right? That's a place to start.
Yeah.
But at least once a year, I'd look at everything within our ministry, our department, and yeah. say, hey, what's working, what's not working? And how do we get better? And I don't know if there's a lot of pastors out there that get complacent. I don't know if it's just because they're afraid of change. I would hope that, you know, if they're the leaders of their organizations, that, you know, they'd be a little bit more drivers and not resistant to change. But, you know, you got to take inventory of the flock. And I'm not talking about cutting people, but I'm definitely talking about, hey, if, you know, like you said, there's something that you're doing that's not really advancing the mission
yeah.
of the organization. Why are we doing it? You have to be able to ask, why are we doing it?
Yeah.
And if what's keeping you from doing that is, you know, the sweet little guy or gal that pitched you on the ministry 3 years ago is getting $500 a month and that's keeping them afloat. I mean, it's a tough conversation to have,
sure.
but hey, you know, if God's our provider, he's our provider and he's going to take care of the church and that little, and that person and, right. and the pastor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think sometimes people just out of complacency, they are not willing to take a real inventory of what's mm-hmm. going on. But you have to ask, what is the purpose? Is this yeah. still, you know, something that we need to be doing? And if people are willing to have those conversations, I think their organization will only get better and grow as time progresses.
And they'll grow too as leaders mm-hmm. by being willing to have those conversations in the sure. first place, kind of weeding out, you know, the things that aren't really helpful. Obviously, you know, you want to do that tactfully and all of that, but,
sure.
You know, especially if it's not something that directly involves people, but it's just this project, we've been doing this thing for 20 years and we have no idea why we started it
yep.
or why we're even doing it anymore.
Yep.
Should be a no-brainer to redirect those funds.
I got, this is something to share.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this applies to everyone. This applies to pastors, to business owners. This applies to everyone. When you start a church, when you start a business, there's a small group of people that's pretty much with you from the get-go.
Yeah.
And they're with you in the trenches. They're with you in the good, the bad, and the ugly. They help you get over that, you know, first 2 years, first 5 years. And you have a special love for those people.
Yeah, that's right.
That you don't just have for everybody. Right?
Yep.
You are loyal to these people because they're clearly loyal to you. What I've seen across the board, ministry, business, you name it, leaders have a hard time building and growing past those people. And so a lot of these other ministries that were started, a lot of these things that might not be effective anymore, typically they're run by some of these people that were with them from the get-go.
Oh, yeah.
And it's almost like the pastor would feel disloyal.
Hmm.
The pastor would feel almost like they're gypping the very people that helped them get there.
Yeah.
I see that in business. I see it everywhere. And yes, there's a loyalty to those people. But if you're really looking at the organization as a whole, if you're really looking at what's best for the organization, if you're really looking at what's best for the mission of the organization, there will be times in the growth of that organization where other people, different people, new people will be more equipped to carry that mission on. And people that you might have started with aren't the ones to fill those roles anymore.
Sure.
And that's a whole nother level of,
yeah.
you know, I've had conversations with those pastors that say, you know what, I don't want to grow past this. I'm happy here. This is my spiritual family.
Exactly.
I'm happy here. And if you're happy there and that's the decision you make, great.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No problem.
Yeah.
But you can't be crying about the fact that you're not growing and you're missioning because you're not willing to maybe make some of the, you know, personnel changes that might be required.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've heard the term spiritual nepotism, you know, not even physical, you know, as far as biological.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, pastors have spiritual sons and daughters.
Yep.
People that they've raised up and mentored and trained for 5, 10, 15 years. And, you know, I think many of them are hoping to leave those spiritual sons and daughters an inheritance. And the thought of, you know, replacing them or them not serving mm-hmm. in, you know, the same role, it's a really tough thing for them. And so, but I see that in business. I see it everywhere. And so it just depends on how much do you really want to grow.
Yeah.
And the guys that just keep growing and growing and growing and growing, they're not afraid to constantly bringing in new talent, additional yeah. talent. They're always training. Yeah. They're always recruiting. And they just have a different drive. They have a bigger vision.
Yeah.
And they're willing to pursue it.
I've heard on, I don't remember which podcast I was listening to, they were telling a story about this company who was basically cutting an entire, I don't know if division is the right word, but just some element of their company that had been going on for years but was no longer effective. And what was really, you know, kind of inspiring about the story was that rather than just kind of saying, all right, you know, however many workers they had in this division, you know, bye, see you later. They actually said, you know what, we're going to invest back into you.
Yep.
And hey, we've got this new project going on over here we could really use your help with.
Right.
And let us train you to go do this new job, you know, instead of the job you've been doing for 20 years.
Yep.
And offer them an opportunity to continue along with the ride.
Yep.
While continuing to produce results and yep. advance the mission forward. I think that's a great way to, it's not an out, you know yep. what I mean? But it's an opportunity for a pastor who maybe is struggling with that
yep.
to say, hey, I've got my four or five core men and women that have been through the trenches with me, and we don't need this particular aspect of what they've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, let me reinvest into you
yep.
and bring you alongside us in a different role.
Yep.
And at that point, it's their choice, isn't it? You know, they can say, yeah, I'm totally on board for that. Or, you know, maybe then if they're not, you know, you find a different way to approach it.
Yep.
Have you seen that at work before in businesses or in churches?
I have. And I think those staff members or employees or leaders, those that are really tied to the mission and those are really tied to the vision and truly loyal, they will put their pride aside and acknowledge the fact that, you know what, I'm no longer the right person for what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And if they're still tied to the vision and loyal to, you know, whatever, they will go do something else.
Yep.
But, you know, I've also seen the times where they're like, you know, their pride flares up and, you know, they play the card, I've been here from the beginning, and they play the seniority card, and this church wouldn't be here without me. And
yeah.
And it gets ugly. And it's like, man, that's your flesh coming out with a vengeance, and that's gross. And
I love you.
And you know, I still want you to be a part, but you know, some of those people they can't remain a part if they're not in charge. And you know, then was it really loyalty or was it ego? Was
yeah.
it pride? And you know, what was it?
Maybe it used to be a loyalty, but now it's morphed into something different.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Exactly. And you know, people are people, and you know, we all have a flesh, and it can get dirty sometimes. And you know, you want to avoid that. And I think sometimes leaders, they avoid those conversations because they never even wanted to get there. But that's to the detriment of their mission. It's
yeah.
to the detriment of their organization. And so the best leaders that I've ever met, they're always open to bringing on new talent. They're always
yeah.
open to training up more people. They're not just, you know, tied to those original 12 or 4 or whatever
yeah.
it is. And so,
wow, this has been really, really insightful. And I mean, just lots of wisdom here on what we've been talking about. I really, really appreciate your time.
Mm.
You know, if people want to connect with you, what's the best way for them to do that? I don't know if you have social or an email address or whatever. What would be the best way for people to get in touch with you if they
sure.
want to talk?
Email's good. I'd say jclark@pbfirm.com. jclark@peanutbutterfirm.com. It's not really Peanut Butter Firm, but people know what PB is.
Oh, man. Yeah, thanks again, Jack. This has been great. I really appreciate it.
You're so welcome.
Well, that was a fascinating and wisdomful conversation. I mean, Jack is so smart. I hope you had your notepads out. You were taking copious notes about how your organization can engage high wealth donors. If you enjoyed this conversation, Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, rate it, review it, share it with your friends, and be sure to check out my blog at www.missiondrivenbudget.com/blog. There I write about powerful budgeting and finance strategies that will help you fund your organization's mission. I hope you enjoyed our conversation today. See you next time.